If you enjoy rabbits, you'll love our other podcast, Tanis. Tanis is a docudrama about an ancient and mysterious myth, perhaps the last genuine mystery of the information age. Download the podcast The Guardian calls compelling and wildly addictive at itunes.com/Tanis or tanispodcast.com. Tanis, it's television for your ears.
Ready when you are.
You believe your friend was playing rabbits?
She started seeing mysterious men in gray.
What did she ask you?
She asked me how many steps to the lighthouse.
What do you know about chaos theory?
The streets were red, then black with blood.
That sounds poetic. Where are you now?
The bottom line isn't money or purpose. It's inspiration.
Are we still going to have sex?
I'm afraid not.
She believed Hazel killed Emily Masters.
Maybe later.
For sure, later. I first heard about the game shortly after my best friend, Yumiko Takada, disappeared. I started this podcast because I want to find out what happened to my friend. From the Public Radio Alliance and Minnow Beats Whale, you're listening to Rabbits. I'm Carly Parker. Stay with us. Hearing Yumiko's voice on the message was shocking, and it changed the tone of my investigation from one of urgency due to Jones's implied ticking clock of multidimensional weirdness to a much more visceral and physical immediacy. Yumiko was in trouble, and I needed to find her. At no point did I actually believe my friend had taken off to India or somewhere to find herself without letting anyone know. But before hearing her voice on that recording, something like that had remained a distant possibility. Now it was clear. She was, or had been, in very real and immediate danger. About 10 seconds after I'd listened to Yumiko's message for the first time, I heard something outside my apartment building. I made my way over to the window and looked down at the street. Standing in the middle of the road were two figures, dressed in gray. I couldn't make out their faces, but I could tell they were looking up at my building. Right at my window. Right at me. I called Jones and told him what was happening. He told me to keep my eye on the people in gray and to stay put. I hung up and did my best to keep looking at the figures. It was strange. I stared at them and they stood there, staring back for a long time. But then they were, or became, inconsistent. Kind of fluttering, if that makes any sense. They would start to disappear momentarily, the longer I stared. I would have to turn away and look back sometimes, just to keep them in focus. It could have been the dimly lit street, but it felt weird. About 5 minutes after I spoke with Jones, the figure stepped out from the middle of the street and moved toward the front door of my building. I pressed record on my voice recorder and sat down with my back to the window, a huge butcher knife in my shaky hands, and waited. It's been a few minutes since they moved toward the front door of my building. I can't hear anything. There's somebody coming up the elevator. I can hear them moving down the hall. They stopped in the hall outside. I can see shadows moving in the crack beneath my door. They're here. Shit!
Carly! Carly!
I jumped up and opened the door. I'd never been so happy to see another human being in my life. I hugged Jones for too long before I remembered that I wasn't sure if I trusted him or not. After things settled down, we checked around the perimeter of my building. There was nobody there. We came back upstairs, and I told Jones what I'd found. I told him about the numbers from that bathroom stall and played him the recording of Yumiko. What do you think?
Sounds like Yumiko was worried, that she knew she didn't have much time.
Do you think those people outside could have been wardens?
I don't know. Maybe. How are you feeling?
What? You mean, did I imagine the figures in the street because I'm super stressed out? My friend is missing? I just heard her voice on a strange recording that we found by following a series of insane, impossible clues. And you've been talking nonstop, pretty convincingly, I might add, about the end of the world?
I don't talk nonstop, do I?
They were out there. Two of them. Standing in the street, looking up. Right into my window.
I believe you.
Could you tell me again exactly what was happening with you and Yumiko?
I started helping her play the game.
The escort stuff?
I had no idea she was going to try and pose as an escort. I would never have allowed that.
Well, it's hard to stop Yumiko from doing something once she sets her mind to it.
Well, you two have a lot in common.
What else?
She'd uncovered a John connected to a few of the escorts, but somebody with a clue to Rapids.
The lighthouse.
It wasn't clear. It just felt like the next move.
What happened after that?
You know the rest. Yumiko had been digging into Emily Masterson's death. She was convinced it was Hazel, or me. It wasn't long before she found the same photo you did. When she found out I was Hazel, she stopped talking to me. I made contact with you as soon as I found out you were looking into her disappearance.
That's it?
That's it.
Jones and I listened to the recording a few more times and made some notes. I opened my laptop to research the text from the message. But before I could look into any of that stuff, I saw the headlines. Alan Scarpio was in the hospital, in critical condition. Sometime late yesterday afternoon, he'd slipped on his pool deck and cracked his head on the cement. He was discovered by his housekeeper. He's currently in a medically induced coma. Alan Scarpio was the best source of information I had on Hazel or Jones, or whoever he is. And now Scarpio was out of the picture. I called the number I had for the courier, who'd delivered the Defender 2 logic board to Yumiko's gym. The number was out of service. I I received a text from Yumiko's brother, Adam, about an hour after Jones arrived at my place. He was meeting with the police for an update on Yumiko. He invited me to join him. I wasn't allowed to record that meeting, but I'll summarize it for you. The police had uncovered security camera footage of Yumiko at the Peace Arch border crossing into Canada. She's sitting in the passenger seat of a silver Saab 900. She turns and stares right into the camera and smiles. The reason the border agency flagged the footage is due to the fact that, other than this video footage, they have no record of a woman named Yumiko Takata crossing the border. No record of her passport. Nothing at all. An apparent computer error resulted in the car's occupants being flagged as unknown. The only thing they had was the border agent's recollection of the occupants of the car stating their destination as Vancouver Island. Apparently, there was also something wrong with the server that held the driver's side and license plate cameras from that date. The police told us that they had somebody wading through that footage from their backup servers, and they'd let us know as soon as they had it. They figured, if they could ID the person driving the car, they'd have something to go on. The fact that Yumiko smiled into the camera, however, could indicate that Yumiko knew her captor, or was okay with whoever was driving that car. The only thing we could think of was, maybe she was heading to a lighthouse. Jones and I went through every lighthouse on Vancouver Island, looking for some kind of clue or indicator that might help us narrow things down. There were a whole lot of them, and almost all of them had steps, stairs, or ladders. Nothing stood out as far as the names, or the names in relation to the number 6878. We discussed driving up to Canada and taking a ferry to Vancouver Island, but we had no idea where to go once we got there. I called my friend Nick, a Canadian, who actually splits his time between Seattle and Vancouver.
Carly Parker, what's up?
So many things.
I've heard. How are you holding up?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hey, could you look into something for me? I sent you an email a minute ago.
Sure, what is it?
It's a recording from Yumiko. But there's another voice, a male, talking about design and architecture.
Okay, what is it you're looking for, exactly?
Well, a name would be great, but I'll take anything you can dig up. I wasn't able to find anything, but I've been a bit, busy.
Right.
Also, apparently Yumiko was spotted at the Canadian border in a silver Saab 900. They were headed for Vancouver Island.
Wow. Okay. Are you sure everything's okay?
Yeah.
Do you think Yumiko really was working as an escort?
No way. No.
No?
No.
Good.
Call me back if you dig up anything on that recording, okay?
Will do.
Thanks. I hung up with Nick and sat down to go over everything I had on Yumiko. She watched that weird video, took some sexy photos that didn't show her face, posted those pictures online, signed up for an escort review site, went to the Natural History Museum to look at the birds, asked a man in a hotel room how many steps to the lighthouse, took a book out of the library, ended up in that diner writing on the bathroom stall, and drove across the border into Canada, possibly headed toward Vancouver Island somewhere. Jones told me that Yumiko had stopped talking to him when she found the photo evidence that he was Hazel, sometime before she went to the Natural History Museum. I remembered something as I was rehashing this stuff in my mind. While I was looking for other escorts to contact regarding the John Yumiko had seen in that hotel room, I saw a bunch of escort websites, including a site for Amy X, the escort who led me to the guy to whom Yumiko asked the question, How many steps to the lighthouse? Amy X's photos were almost identical to Yumiko's. The same type of poses, the same type of lighting. Even more telling, the same curtains and dresser. I called her and asked about the photographer who'd taken those pictures.
Hello?
Hey, Amy. It's Carly Parker again.
Hey.
Hey, I called you a while ago about my missing friend.
Lissandra.
Right, Lissandra.
Is she okay?
I'm still looking.
It's been a while.
Yeah. So listen, I noticed some similarities between your photographs and my friend's. Similar poses, lighting, framing.
It's Loris.
Loris?
She's the shutterbug, the bellhop at the hotel.
At what hotel?
The place your friend met the creepy guy who gave me the shitty review.
Loris at the hotel?
Yeah.
You think he might have taken those photos of Yumiko or Lysandra?
Loris takes a lot of the girls' photos. He's not creepy. Doesn't try and trade favors or anything.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
So, I went back to that hotel and spoke with Loris, full-time bellman and part-time photographer. I found him setting up a photo shoot in one of the hotel's rooms. Hi, are you Loris?
Yeah, hey, you're looking for some photos?
No, not exactly.
I'm sorry, I thought you were something.
I'm the one who called and asked to meet about getting some photos, and I'd like to pay you for your time, but I'd just like to ask you a couple questions.
You a cop?
No, I'm not the police. I'm looking for my missing friend. Her name is Yumiko.
I remember her. Yeah, she was really pretty.
Right, she is.
She had a whole stack of books and papers. She seemed a lot more like a scientist than an escort.
Did she do anything? Can you remember anything else? Do you remember what the books are about?
Yeah, actually, I do. That's easy. They were mostly picture books of North American lighthouses.
Lighthouses?
Yeah, I remember that because my crazy uncle lived in a lighthouse for years in Iceland.
Can you think of anything else?
She was on the phone for a little bit. I don't...
Do you remember what she...
No.
What was she talking about?
No, I didn't hear anything she said. She kind of moved to the other side of the room, and I couldn't really make out anything she was saying specifically. I heard some science-y stuff. Technical stuff.
Okay. Anything else? Anything at all?
No, I'm afraid that's it. She was only here for about 10 minutes.
Really? That's it?
Yeah. She looked out the window and freaked out.
Wait, what do you mean?
I mean, I'd taken about 5 pictures. She was over by the curtains for the last one. She looked outside and saw something. After that, she packed up her books and ran out the door. She didn't even put on her shoes.
Wait, this window over here?
Yeah. I looked out the window right after she left, but there was nothing there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I looked out that window as well. And there was something that I could see. Squarespace is the best, and that's why we use Squarespace to make every single website here at the Public Radio Alliance. We need a lot of websites, and Squarespace is so easy, clean, and elegant. Squarespace just works, and because we use Squarespace for everything, our sites look good wherever you happen to be looking at them. Laptops, desktops, and mobile devices. Their incredible award-winning designer templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. Create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade, ever. If you have a passion that you obsess over, like running down the street against your better judgment, chasing mysterious figures in gray, or selling old VHS copies of movies that may never have existed online. Whatever it is that keeps you up at night, that drives you creatively, you need to get it out there. If you need a domain as well, Squarespace offers a unique domain experience that's fully transparent and simple to set up. So, share your ideas with the world. Start your free trial site today at squarespace.com. when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code RABBITS to get 10% off your first purchase. That's squarespace.com and use the offer code RABBITS. Squarespace. Make your next move. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like our podcast. Listen whenever you want, whenever it's convenient for you. Why are you still going to the post office and dealing with their limited hours when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? We use Stamps.com here at the Public Radio Alliance because Stamps.com makes everything incredibly easy, but also because we want to save time and money. Stamps.com is convenient, easy, reliable, and flexible. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. With Stamps.com, buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. Unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. Print postage for letters or packages at your convenience, 24/7. So whether you're sending out letters asking for help decoding a message hidden in a box of cereal from the 1970s, or you're sending fan mail to your favorite podcast, you know, the podcast about that potentially mythic, strange, and ancient game, you need to save time and money. You need Stamps.com. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code RABBITS for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without the long-term commitments. Get started with Stamps.com today, and within minutes, you'll be printing postage right from your desk. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in RABBITS. That's Stamps.com, enter RABBITS. With Stamps.com, you'll never have to go to the post office again. It was a billboard for a brand new singer's debut album. There was a graphic that matched the title of the album on the right side of the billboard. Floating above the graphic was the shadow from a satellite dish on a nearby building. It looked like a dark full moon. A dark full moon floating above a pyramid. The singer's debut album was called Pyramid. The graphic and the shadow together. It was the moonrise. I looked down at the street and saw Jones waiting beside my car. I wanted to yell down to get his attention, but the hotel's windows had been painted shut. It was at this point that I saw the figures in gray. Two of them. They were walking slowly toward Jones, one on either side of the street. I scrambled for my phone and tried to dial, but there was no signal. I asked Loris for his phone, but he didn't have a signal either. He said it was strange, that there was normally no problem with the cell reception in that area. I grabbed my things and ran out the door. It must have felt like Yumiko all over again for him. A young woman looking out the window and leaving in a panic. It felt like the elevator took forever to arrive. There's no way Jones was going to be able to get away from the wardens if he didn't see them. Finally, the elevator arrived and I got in. My stomach was fluttering, my hands shaking. The elevator slowly moving past the halfway point. I sprinted out of the elevator doors, ran through the lobby, and out into the street. Jones was there, looking at something on his phone. He looked up as I burst through the doors of the hotel and started running toward him.
What?
There were no signs of the wardens anywhere. I pointed up at the billboard of the pyramid, but the shadow from the satellite dish didn't hit in the same place from down here. There was no moonrise. No wardens, and no moonrise. My heart was still racing. Jones had an idea while I was up in that room talking to the photographer. He found out that the ferry company in British Columbia took reservations, and he suggested that I reach out to Yumiko's brother and see if he could find out if she put a ferry reservation on her credit card. I called Adam, but there was nothing on her credit card after the day she disappeared. I thought about Alan Scarpio, in a coma, in the hospital. Was there any chance his being in the hospital wasn't somehow connected to rabbits? I understood that there was no way a regular person could just walk into a hospital and visit a billionaire in a coma. No way, that is, unless you happen to be on the approved visitors list. I called the hospital and asked about the visiting procedure. They told me it was family and approved visitors only. I gave them my name and a brief message to pass on to any of Scarpio's family. That's when the nurse told me that the name Carly Parker was already on the approved visitors list. I went to the hospital immediately. Jones insisted on coming with me. He didn't think either of us should be alone. As much as I was still concerned about who to trust, I was happy to have the company. Intensive care was on the second floor. A nurse led us through the east wing toward a private section, where we passed through a quick security checkpoint. Something I found surprising, Jones was on the approved visitor list as well. He was listed as simply Mr. Jones. The nurse said it's at the end of the hall. 209. This is it. I knocked and we entered the room. Scarpio was in bed, hooked up to a bunch of machines via a series of wires and tubes. These machines were brand new, cutting edge. I wouldn't have been surprised to see the price tags on everything. There were two people sleeping on a small sofa next to the bed. They popped up as we entered. It was the magician and his assistant, or whatever she was, the aviator goggle young woman from the arcade. Scarlet. What are you doing here?
We came as soon as we heard.
You know Scarpio?
Of course. We're very close. Jones?
Hey. How is he?
Not good.
Why are we on the visitors list?
Because we need you.
For what?
Did you tell her nothing?
I told her everything. Mostly.
We need you to win the game.
How?
Well, that part is unclear.
Best guess?
You need to find your missing friend.
Does Scarpio have any contact with Yumiko?
I don't know. I don't think so. She didn't mention him.
Wait, you spoke to Yumiko?
Of course.
When?
When she came to ask me about the game.
When was that?
I'm not sure about the date, but sometime before you two visited the arcade.
What did she want?
She was looking for information on Hazel, mainly.
You didn't tell her about me?
It's not my place to reveal those who wish to remain hidden, Jones.
Is there anything else you can tell us about what she was looking into at the time?
There was something about a film producer and his new film.
What film?
I can't remember, or maybe she didn't tell me.
Really? That's it?
Sorry.
Jones and I went back to my place and looked up every single film that was opening or had opened around the time of Yumiko's disappearance. Nothing stood out. There was a very famous film festival taking place in Europe around that time. I pulled up the list of films. Nothing stood out there either, until I did an image search and saw the poster for a Dutch film called To Fall. The poster featured a familiar image. It was Dog Lover in Hell. The word To Fall, in Dutch, means coincidence. Jones was looking into flights to Europe when I found something else. It was an article from an online entertainment news outlet. The famously reclusive producer of that film was having an exclusive party at his house, somewhere in Canada, to celebrate them winning an award at the festival. It was, allegedly, a masquerade party. Apparently something about masks lined up with the theme of the film. The director and stars would be in attendance. The only clue to the location of the reclusive producer's house was that guests would be arriving by private boat. The only worthwhile lead we had was this film producer. We needed to find this guy. Soon. We were unable to track down anyone who knew or was willing to reveal the location of the reclusive producer's house. We had no idea if he lived in Toronto, Montreal, or Vancouver. That is, until I heard back from Nick. He told me that a friend of his was still looking into the recording of Yumiko's that I found via that 6878 phone number, but that he did find something on a Silver Saab 900. Apparently there was a Silver Saab 900 on a ferry to someplace called Galliano Island the day that Yumiko was spotted at the Canadian border crossing. The time matched perfectly. If she'd driven directly from the border to the ferry terminal, she would have made it just in time to catch that ferry to Galliano Island. Galliano Island is one of the southern Gulf Islands between Vancouver and Vancouver Island. It's about a 45-minute ferry ride from Vancouver. It didn't take long to narrow down the area on Galliano, most likely to house the well-known producer. There were at least a dozen really upscale residences around the southeast end of the island. They were a long distance apart, but it looked like we'd have time to check them all. I sat down with Jones to make plans, to try and figure out what to do next. We went back over everything we've been able to learn so far. We decided whatever happened to Yumiko must have happened up in Canada. The next morning, we'd load up my car and drive across the border to Vancouver. Jones told me that he believed we were running out of time. That night, I had the dream of the beach and the elevator. Jones told me later that he'd had the dream as well. He was looking haggard, worried. I imagined he was looking at me and thinking the exact same thing. It felt like whatever was happening, we were getting close to the end. There was a long line at the border. It took us hours to get through. We hit rush hour in Vancouver, which was terrible. And then, finally, we missed the 5:30 ferry. The next ferry didn't leave until 8:25 p.m. Jones bought us some food and something to drink. By the time we made it to Galliano Island, it was dark. Something started happening on the ferry. I began seeing shapes, dark shapes over the water, and I began feeling a sense of disconnectedness that was increasing the closer we got to the island. Jones told me that he was experiencing something similar. He was worried that if we didn't hurry up and do whatever it was we needed to do, that we were going to slip away, that something terrible and final was about to happen. The wind was blowing across the ocean. I looked across at the lights of Galliano Island in the distance. Whatever was going to happen, it was going to happen soon. I received a text message from Nick as soon as we got off the ferry. He told me that he'd emailed information on the recording that I'd sent him of Yumiko and that other man. But there was no service. I received the SMS message, but I was unable to access the email. Jones had the same problem. We arrived at a locked gate. There was no nighttime access to the private road, so we had to park the car and walk about a quarter of a mile to a private beach. By the time we made it to the part of the island with the handful of large helipad-equipped mansions, our eyes had adjusted and we could see our feet ahead of us as we walked. The moon was bright, and the sound of the sea was deceptively soothing as we made our way along the rocky beach. There were five or six homes that accessed this particular beach. We checked them all. Three of them appeared to be vacant, and one was the residence of a local woodworker who'd been watching television alone in his living room when we knocked and interrupted his evening. He slammed the door in our faces. He wasn't in the mood to tell us about any of the other residents of the island. We turned back toward the beach, and that's when we saw them. They were walking along the shore toward us. At least a dozen figures, all dressed in gray. Jones grabbed my arm, and we started to run. The figures, although clearly walking while we ran, never lost any ground. It was strange. They were continually behind us. I had the feeling that we weren't going to lose them. Not this time. We ran up the beach until we came to the next house. We continued to run up and around the side of the house, the figures in gray in steady pursuit. The side of the house that wasn't on the beach was in the middle of a cul-de-sac. We had entered a residential area. We stopped running and just walked quickly. The figures in gray appeared to maintain their distance, or perhaps they were gaining a little with each step. That's when I received an alert. That email from Nick had come through. The message was about the recording. Apparently, the voice on that recording belonged to an architect. An architect named Arthur Light.
Separating biology into behavioral sciences from architecture is a fatal mistake.
I knew that name. He was a famous mid-century architect, one of the fathers of the West Coast modern movement. Jones and I slowed down again. The figures in gray continued to match our movements. It was terrifying. I couldn't stop looking back. I knew that they were eventually going to catch up, somehow. I just didn't know when. We continued to move along the residential street toward another cul-de-sac directly in front of us. As we moved through the second well-lit area, the street lights started to switch off behind us, one by one. It was weird. Surreal. As we passed each light, it went dark. In the darkness, I knew that the figures in gray were there, slowly, getting closer, and that it wouldn't be long before they reached us. It wouldn't be long now before something terrible and final happened. Now that my phone had service, I did a quick search for Arthur Light. It turns out he'd designed numerous homes in British Columbia, Canada, including the only house he ever built for himself. A house that was recently purchased by a well-known reclusive Hollywood producer. A house located right here, on Galliano Island. The house wasn't far from where we were, just down at the end of the next beach. I grabbed Jones again and pulled him forward. There was no way I was going to let them catch up before we made it to that house. To Arthur Light's house. The lighthouse. We continued to move quickly along the rocky beach, staying just ahead of the figures in gray. As we moved closer to a seemingly endless set of wooden stairs winding up the side of a steep rock face, we could hear voices from the house at the end of those stairs. We ran up the first set of steps leading up to the modernist house on the hill. The first set of 68 steps was followed, of course, by a second set of 78. By the time we reached the house at the top of that rocky hill, we were both panting and barely able to stand. The figures in gray were right behind us, and at this point, there appeared to be hundreds of them. We turned and ran into the house. As we moved into the house, time seemed to slow. There were 100 or so guests, maybe more, all of them wearing masks. As advertised, it was definitely a masquerade party. Time felt strange here, elusive. My eyes were drawn immediately to one figure as she moved across the room. A slender female with long, dark hair. She wore a beautiful porcelain mask. The mask of a rabbit. I moved through the crowd toward the woman in the mask. I couldn't tell you if anybody noticed me or not. I was focused on nothing but the woman. I saw her enter a room at the end of a long hall. I made my way through the crowded hall toward the door and burst into the room. But the room was empty. It was a bedroom. There was a king-sized bed and a small love seat. I looked under the bed and in the closet, but there was nobody there. The woman in the mask just disappeared. I turned back toward the hallway and saw the figures in gray. There were no longer any party guests. Jones was nowhere to be seen. Everyone had become or been replaced by a figure in gray. I couldn't make out any faces. It was as if looking directly at them was impossible. Out of the corner of my eye, I felt like I could see them better, but their faces remained obscured. They appeared to be wearing the masks of the party guests, which was unsettling. But not as unsettling as the fact that everyone was completely silent. It was a strange and terrifying total silence. Then, they slowly started walking toward me, toward the room at the end of the hall. Just before they were about to reach me, I spun around and re-entered the bedroom, shutting the door behind me. That's when I saw her. She was sleeping on the love seat, white rabbit mask on the floor. It was Yumiko. She woke up and rubbed her eyes. Yumiko was fine, but she didn't remember anything at all. In fact, the last thing she remembered was being at home, listening to music, the night she disappeared. After a few calls back and forth, the Canadian authorities finally arrived on the island. They told me later that they found me in a pretty bad way. The way I looked, the things I was saying. On drugs, they said. It was the same once we got back to Seattle. I continued to tell them everything I remembered, and they were diligent about writing it down and recording everything. But I could tell from pretty early on that they thought I was either nuts, under the influence of hallucinogenic narcotics, or both. The detective looking into Yumiko's disappearance indicated that she believed a lack of sleep and a great deal of pressure and stress probably had something to do with everything that had happened to me. They were looking into the producer, but they appeared to be coming up empty there. Neither he nor Yumiko appeared to recognize each other. To complicate things further, the producer hadn't been living in his house on Galliano Island. In fact, it had been sitting there empty for the last 6 months. Which brings us to Jones. The police eventually managed to track down the border crossing photos of the license plate and driver's side camera of that Silver Saab 900. Jones was driving, and the car was registered to him. The police were looking for him. Jones's real name was Jeremy Caruth. Yumiko looked at his picture. She couldn't remember ever seeing him before in her life. They believed that the most likely theory was that Jones had taken Yumiko to the island and kept her prisoner there, perhaps drugged for some sinister purpose. This would explain her memory loss and the traces of benzodiazepines in her system. I was tested for drugs as well, and there were two conflicting toxicology reports. One was clean, but the other indicated possible trace amounts of LSD in my system. They had me examined by a psychiatrist who said something about extreme duress and prescribed some medication to help me get through any rough patches I might be experiencing. The psychiatrist recommended I start attending weekly counseling sessions immediately. As far as Jones, or Jeremy Caruth, goes, he had a long history of institutionalization. Apparently, he'd been in and out of medical facilities his entire life. His longer stays were for schizophrenia and extreme paranoia. Reports indicated that, as a child, he would create false realities and attempt to live his life in complex, make-believe worlds. They said he most likely did this to escape the reality of his home life, his abusive parents. While living in a kind of minimum security home care situation in 2008, Jeremy Caruth, working under the name Jerusalem Jones, allegedly came up with the most complex alternate reality game ever created up to that point. It was a game called Moonrise. In 1998, Caruth was accused of providing large doses of benzodiazepines to his then-girlfriend, Emily Masterson. These allegations were never substantiated. Emily overdosed on a combination of that medication and antidepressants later that year. This led Caruth into a spiral of depression that would last until at least 2007. The police eventually decided that both Yumiko and myself may have been the victims of some kind of brainwashing or Stockholm Syndrome situation, where we were fed doses of LSD and benzodiazepines, drugs notorious for affecting both short and long-term memory, and that Jeremy Caruth was responsible. I spoke with Yumiko at length about her audio recordings, that video, and everything else, but she didn't remember any of it. She firmly believed that Rabbits was nothing more than a weird game, and although she was worried about her missing time, she felt fine, and really, just wanted to get on with her life. I eventually convinced Yumiko to try hypnosis and a few other forms of regression therapy, but nothing worked. Her memories appeared to be lost. It didn't take long before the calls from the police stopped, and all thoughts of Jones and Rabbits seemed to fade from Yumiko's mind. My mind, however, was another story. Could Jones really have made all of this up? Hired people to play wardens? Had I been drugged somehow? Did he spike my drink before we got on that ferry? Is that why I was feeling so strange on that island? Or was it because we were actually close to creating some kind of slip? Could he have somehow accessed Gatewick Industries Subproject 54, that top-secret concussion program that used sub-oral frequency blasts to erase Yumiko's memory? Or was Jones on the level? Had we actually completed something? Did we facilitate the slip? Were we now living in an altered reality? Did we save the world? If so, where was Jones? Sometimes I was certain that it was real, that Jones and I did complete something, something important. Other times, I felt like the possibility that some ancient game might actually be capable of altering dimensions was ridiculous, and I couldn't believe that I'd ever actually entertained the thought. Most of the time, my thoughts would tend to the former. There were just too many things that didn't make sense otherwise. But there were a couple of things that forced me to seriously consider the latter option. One was Christina's world. Every version of the painting I could find, including all of the digital copies on my phone and computer, were normal. Two windows in the farmhouse, not three. There was no evidence that a version with three windows had ever existed. But I clearly remember that painting. I clearly remember three windows. The second thing was a meeting that I had with the president of a company called Gatewick Industries, a few weeks after the incident at Galliano Island.
Carly Parker?
Yes.
Morris Nevin, it's nice to meet you.
Thank you for agreeing to meet with me.
Of course. I understand you have a couple of questions about what we do here at Gatewick Industries.
Well, I was just basically wondering what you do.
Well, the easiest answer is we make games.
What kind of games?
We started with role-playing and card games back in the 80s. These days we're pretty big into virtual and augmented reality. Our newest beta games are inspired by LARPing. Do you know what that is?
Live-action role-playing, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, our version of LARPing is a bit more ambitious.
Like how?
Well, kind of like real life. You know, like the David Fincher movie? The Game?
Right.
Let's just say that we've been developing something unique. A game where the playing field is actually real life.
Like an alternate reality game.
Yes, but much more ambitious than anything that's been tried before. Kind of like the game in your podcast. But, of course, our game isn't actually dangerous.
Of course. How come you don't have an online presence?
We find that it takes away the mystery.
Right. Do you know anything about my parents working for Gatewick? Or taking part in any experiments?
I looked up their names. I'm afraid there's nothing.
And what about Jeremy Caruth? He was working for you. For Gatewick.
Wish that wasn't the case. But somehow he managed to pass our screening process. We believe that Caruth, or somebody working on his behalf, hacked into certain systems. Mr. Caruth was beta testing something for us. He worked on the fringes of the design team, doing some game testing for some of our new augmented reality stuff. He agreed to participate in part of our first live-action simulation.
A game?
Like a beta version, yes. We had a team of operatives follow him around. It was kind of a logistics test for our new spy property, you know, to help establish parameters for real-life gameplay.
You had people following him?
Yes.
People dressed in gray?
Why, yes. The game was called Gray Ops. I heard that you saw a few of our people during your experience with Mr. Caruth.
I did.
Well, they were instructed to make no contact.
They didn't.
Great. Are there any additional questions that I can answer for you?
Well, is your spy game a Gray Ops?
Yes.
Is it happening?
Well, not in that form. We are reworking it for VR. We decided that at the present time, real-world gameplay is just too complex and unpredictable.
Right. I didn't know what to think. If I say that I believe in multidimensional slips capable of realigning our world or universe, am I crazy? Was the story I just told you corrupt? False? My imagination gone wild? What about the moonrise? My brother showed me that image when I was just a kid, and there were just so many things that couldn't be explained away. And I would absolutely know if I was being drugged and manipulated, wouldn't I? It wasn't long after Yumiko's return that I paid a visit to the magician's bar/arcade. Only, it was no longer a bar/arcade. It was a convenience store with a few small tables where you could drink coffee. The place was called Spino's. It looked brand new. I asked Theodore, the owner, how long it had been there, and he told me that they just opened yesterday. I asked him what had happened to the arcade that had been there before. He told me he thought it had previously been a coffee shop. He wasn't sure, as the place had been completely empty when he and his husband leased it a week or so back. I went to the back of the store to grab a drink, and that's when I saw it. It was standing in the far corner. It was an arcade game. I couldn't tell what game it was. The cabinet was black. There were no graphics of any kind, anywhere.
I noticed there was a video game in your back room.
It was there when we leased the place, just sitting in the middle of the room.
Oh.
We told the owner, but they had no idea. Told us we could keep it.
Does it work?
I don't know, but it turns on.
Would you be willing to let me take a look at it?
You want to buy it?
Maybe.
Knock yourself out.
Thanks.
So, I returned to the back of the store, plugged it in, and waited.
A few seconds later, Stargate booted up. I popped in a quarter and was about to play the game when I had a thought. I decided to try the Easter egg trick first. It took me a couple of tries to get it right. But when I finally did it, I wasn't completely surprised to see the results. It was the circle. Just like at the magician's old place, the first seven names were there, in order, per usual. But this version of the circle was different. Beside the number 8, instead of a dash, there was a name. Hazel. And sitting there, after the number 9, was another name. Parker Carlson. While I was standing there, staring at the names on that screen, the number 10 popped up at the bottom of the list, out of nowhere, and started flashing. So, I dropped in another quarter and started playing the game. It's Rabbits. I'm Carly Parker. Until next time, stay safe. If you enjoy Rabbits, you'll love our other podcast, Tanis. Tanis is a docudrama about an ancient and mysterious myth, perhaps the last genuine mystery of the information age. Download the podcast The Guardian calls compelling and wildly addictive at itunes.com/Tanis or tanispodcast.com. Tanis, it's television for your ears. Rabbits is a Public Radio Alliance and Minnow Beats Whale production. Produced by Hollis Adams Lane. Produced, mixed, and edited by Terry Miles and Carly Parker. Additional editorial and production assistance by Morgan Stevens. Associate producers Tara Pratt and Bailey Everett. Producer Emeritus Mackenzie Howard. Executive producers Terry Miles and Hollis Adams Lane. You can support Rabbits by visiting our website at rabbitspodcast.com and clicking on support in the top right corner. If you enjoy Rabbits, please rate and especially review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you found us. Reviews are key to keeping Rabbits on the charts where people can find our show. Thank you so much for listening to Rabbits. For legal and safety reasons, we've elected to change some names and leave others out entirely. We don't do this very often, but we're not willing to compromise people's safety for any reason. Thanks again for listening to Rabbits.